I don't think I'm recording yet. Okay. Here we go. Yep, seems to be working. Okay, this is about the best we're going to get. Ethics, communication, and computers and computing. Week 7. This particular lecture and PowerPoint presentation and also workshop notes and links that I spent quite a few hours preparing over the last couple of days is available to you from the website, my website, which you can get to through WebCT or straight through my web server. This particular presentation is available at that particular address, right? But just look at the website and it will go through. We're talking about ethics, okay? What is ethics? It means a number of different things to a number of different people. The way I like to think of ethics is thinking back to my travelling days when I was going overseas, and in Europe at the time I was constantly confronted by a character called the Ugly Australian. Now this particular character really only exists overseas, in my opinion. This is the guy, and it's usually a guy, who hangs around in the bars, the hotels, the camping grounds of Europe, and maybe even Asia. When you meet him, you recognise him immediately. He usually travels around with his mates. He gets drunk every night. He acts pretty noisily at night, usually. Sometimes he sticks his backside out of the rear window of cars and buses. He's crass, he's uncivilised, uncouth, and he's not bound by the familiar cultural rules that he is accustomed to in Sydney or Australia. Back home, he's your normal yobbo and would never think to act like he did overseas most of the time. Why? Because, in my opinion, the ethics this character follows are basically grounded in the Australian culture. If you take the culture away, his ethical, well, his behaviour changes. Okay? I've seen this time and time again in Europe and in Asia. People, especially Australians, act up. I mean, Germans do the same thing and so do Americans. But Australians are immediately recognisable to me. And there's a name for this person, the Ugly Australian. Ethics is one of those words which many professionals give lip service to, but hardly really spare a thought about in their normal day-to-day lives. The fact that you belong to the legal profession or have taken the hydroponic oath or can recite your company's policy on such and such an issue. This doesn't automatically make you into an ethical person or an ethical employee. Only by really knowing what's ethically right and ethically correct and actually acting accordingly can you really call yourself an ethical person or an ethical citizen. But what if the ethical guidelines of the profession have not really been established yet? I'm thinking now about people who inhabit the internet, people who inhabit this place called, in the good old terminology, called cyberspace. What if a company's policies are still being considered? How could you really be ethical if the lawmakers and the policy providers cannot actually make up their own minds at any particular time? You would basically struggle, you'd flounder in a sea of complexity and confusion. And this is somewhat the case still at the moment when it comes to the ethics of the internet. Not necessarily computing, but on the internet. We have a situation with two opposing points of view, and that is those people who believe that the current legislations and policies of the government and of companies themselves are flexible enough to simply be amended by changing the law slightly, changing the wording slightly, and thus accommodate people who are, you know, working and behaving and acting on the internet under, let's say, virtual personas. And there are those people who think that that this is not possible, that in fact we really need to think very carefully about what it is we're seeing on the internet. Do the laws really make sense? Do the existing laws make sense, or do we really need to rewrite them and change them quite significantly? Both sides may in fact be correct. Some of the laws may only need cosmetic changes, a few word changes perhaps, whereas other laws might need rewriting entirely. And this is seen to some extent with privacy at the moment. This is a really big issue. My two classes have talked about the fact that in Europe there are hard and fast guidelines as to what companies can do in terms of surveillance of their employees. Because of the background of Europe and communism and various governments, this sort of surveillance is viewed with a great deal of suspicion. And the European Union has taken this on board and said that companies are not allowed, really, to surveil their company employees. There might be exceptions to that, obviously, but this is completely different to the case in America and also Australia, where companies are allowed to surveil their employees. In fact, we are under constant surveillance. You only have to look at the number of cameras set up in labs and the amount of software that's available that can check and filter and keep track, basically, of everything you do whenever you log in to a computer. And these days we all have to log in, don't we? And therefore there's always a track, some sort of invisible virtual log of our actions. The powers that be would say this is because we have to make sure that students aren't hacking. And I would actually counter that and say, well, there's other reasons for doing this. And it's probably the easiest reason, the most understandable reason, is that it's very easy to do. It's entirely possible to check up and make sure that what everyone is doing. This is an example of where ethics is important and where ethical behaviour changes from country to country and continent to continent. Western ideas about ethics, and in fact, have their historical roots going back to Greek philosophy. Socrates, Spinoza, St. Thomas Aquinas, even John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher, amongst others, laid the philosophical foundations for what we know as ethical behaviour. However, modern day ethics, really doesn't start until World War II, when, in fact, the Nuremberg Code in 1946, and you can look this one up, the Nuremberg Code came into effect and became probably the most famous and most used guiding principle for medical ethics and medical behaviour. The way in which people, innocent victims of the Holocaust, were treated and their rights violated disgusted so many people at the Nuremberg trials that the Nuremberg Code became the one of the linchpins, if not the linchpin, of 20th century ethics and ethical behaviour. Since 1947, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came into play and also became another guiding principle for ethical behaviour that most research organisations and most companies also must have a look at and take into account, because these are principles that cannot be violated. They are inviolable. They must be taken into account. That actually means that no one's moving, in fact. That when that goes out, you're so entranced by the speaker that everyone's on the edge of their seat, so I must be doing my job. The problem, however, with these older medical ethics codes is that they don't really have much to do with, you know, things like copyright or privacy or any of these other issues and problems which are much more commonplace. Even though there are wars and even though there are violations of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay and various other places in detention centres, especially in Australia, it was psychologists and psychology who decided that I just lost my screen. Oh, here it is. Thank you very much. I can't get back. It was psychologists and... Yeah, I can't get back. It's the trouble with this bloody stupid thing. All right, here we go. Okay. It was psychologists who were really instrumental in creating the God, I hate computers. Stop recording. It was psychologists who in the 1970s decided they would create some more principles or different principles which really referred to doing research as opposed to medical experiments. So these Belmont principles in 1978 became important. They became useful for anyone who was doing any kind of research, and it was then decided to implement these particular principles in other contexts. For example, companies. From 1978 to the present day, the... I don't believe this thing. You touch it and it just changes. All right. The problem at the present is the internet and ethics and the difference between public knowledge versus private information. There are two linchpins of research ethics, and these are informed consent and the right to privacy. Now, there are more than this these days. However, these two are the most basic. That is, if you're going to do any kind of research or if you're going to work in a company, it is the company or the employer's responsibility to give you informed consent. That is, you have to be informed about what's going on and basically consent. Maybe not in writing, but as we see on our computer screens, you know, there's information there about what's right and what's appropriate behaviour on the computer. And it says, you know, by using this computer system, the user consents to actually abiding by the policies, and these policies might be found at on a particular website. The second linchpin is called the right to privacy, and privacy is a really big issue at the moment. The right to privacy is basic. It's a given. It's a basic human right. How would you feel if, you know, you went home and people had been, you know, the police or ASIO or CIA had been rifling through your mail or your email even? If they'd been walking in your house and checking up on you, looking through all your documents. I mean, I think a lot of people would feel pretty violated if that was to happen. This is a basic human right, this right to privacy. You don't want your name, perhaps, put up as a particular kind of person, as a student of this university. You probably would never do that on a website. You'd never put up your name, your address, your phone number, and your contact details and publicly announce this. But what if someone else did that? You know, if someone else decided that they would take your details and place them on a publicly accessible place, a bulletin board, even something as small as a bulletin board, there are real feelings of violation there that you probably should feel. Now, the problem is that do these principles of informed consent and the right to privacy, do they actually make sense on the internet? The right to privacy and informed consent, let's deal with privacy. Now, privacy is supposed to be about protecting personal information. The problem with using the internet is that none of the information is all that personal. As soon as you start using the internet, no matter who you are, unless you happen to be using someone else's computer, as soon as you start using it, there is a trail of what you're doing. It's kept with your ISP. It's kept with the university. There is a virtual paper trail of everything you do. Your email is certainly not personal information. How many people have access to your email accounts, whether they be Hotmail accounts or UWS accounts or Telstra accounts or Office accounts? More than one. I know that. It's more than just you. So the problem is this. Is your information really all that personal? Is it private? In fact, how can you really surveil someone's information if it wasn't private to begin with, that it was, you know, somewhat public, because more than just you have access to those files? This is a problem. Can you really indict someone for breaking into your mailbox, your email box, and checking on every file that's there, when in fact, you know, other people can do this without you even knowing about it, and, you know, quite legally? Obviously, there has to be more than just you has access to your email box. There has to be systems admin people. There have to be, you know, all sorts of people who have access to these files, who have root access, obviously. So, private information is questionable. Is there such a thing as a private discussion on a bulletin board? Again, the same argument holds true. There have been cases where people have been checking up on others and seen that they've been talking on Usenet news groups, and they've taken that information and published it in other places, and of course they've been found out. And the question is, well, was that information really private? Is it copyrightable, in fact, when, you know, the whole of the news group, maybe the whole of the internet, had access to it anyway? Do you know what I mean? You can't actually say that your telephone number is private if, in fact, it's in the white pages. If anyone can look it up, then that knowledge is public knowledge. You then can't criticize someone else for taking public knowledge and using it somewhat to their own advantage. And this is a problem, I suppose, with spam and also SMS and mobile advertising at the moment, is that people are using publicly accessible databases and using them to market their own products. There has been some new legislation about this fairly recently, although it's fairly limited legislation. The thing about informed consent on the internet is also problematic because I'll tell you a story. Several years ago now, I asked my students who were in a class like this one to do some research for me on using IRC, which is a chat system. It still exists. At the time, IRC was not banned by the university. I think it is, well, it's frowned upon at present. I'm not sure about ban. But IRC was a place where people could go and chat in various channels and groups. Now, I asked my students to actually go and record and log some of these channels. Now, the log command is built into the system. It's built into the Unix version, it's built into the Windows version, every version. Just slash log. Log the channel. No big deal. The only big deal that did occur was when the students actually asked and told the channel users that they were logging their conversations. As soon as they told them, that is, informed people of their actions, all hell broke loose. The students were banned, they were kicked off the system, off the channels, they weren't allowed back. And in fact, someone told me, one of the moderators at the university said, Ray, he said, if you don't stop your students logging files, or telling people they're logging files, that is informing others of what they're doing, then the whole university is going to be banned from using the whole of the IRC network worldwide. And I said, well, you know, use your discretion. Obviously, in order to be ethical here, you actually got punished. Researchers couldn't actually, you know, student researchers couldn't actually do the job. And that also occurs online in many other cases as well, that as soon as you start to ask for informed consent ethically and act in an ethical way, people unethically start to kick you off and start to think really bad things about you. Even though the command was there to use totally surreptitiously, totally secretively, any student could have recorded any conversation totally unknown to anybody except themselves, that command, it's still there on this particular system. The history of computer ethics, according to Tyrell Ward Bynum, is a fairly lengthy one. In the 1940s, Norbert Wiener talked about ethics and cybernetics. So it basically becomes part of computing itself. As computing becomes more acceptable and more used in society, people start to realise that computers can be used unethically. Did anyone see 2001, A Space Odyssey, the other day? Yeah, I mean, a terrific example of the things that could go wrong and the totally unethical behaviour of a computer, which is totally fictitious, of course. Hal, the computer in question, was supposed to be a pseudonym for IBM. You know, of course, that H-A-L, you add one extra letter to H-A-L and it spells IBM. H-I-A-B-L-M. So Hal, in fact, was seen as typifying IBM. If you go and look at it, there are some similarities. the human use of human beings was probably the one of the most important books at the time. It came out, and people started to take notice in the 40s and the 50s. But it was really fairly rarefied. Computer ethics was really about, you know, computer programmers at the time, fairly small bunch of people in the 40s and 50s, using their skills wisely. In the mid-60s, the ACM, the American the Association for Computing Machinery, American Professional Association, very, very important one, wrote their Code of Ethics for the first time. And in 1976, Walter Maynard, who's a fairly big name, coins the term computer ethics as a real justifiable area of a specialist area of ethics. It wasn't until 1976 that computer ethics itself had that sort of association. Before that, it wasn't seen as such a big deal. But obviously, 1985, Deborah Johnson writes a book called Computer Ethics, a great book, one of the first books of its time, and there's been exponential growth in terms of interest and activity in computer ethics from here. In fact, by 1999, Deborah Johnson goes on to say that there is now a new ethics of the information age. I don't know whether you realise it, but we've actually been through the information age. We've actually coming out at the tail end. Just like the Industrial Revolution, I think we've just gone through the Information Revolution. Happened in the last 10 years, actually. Some of you were a part of it. Some of you are still a part of it, obviously. Alongside the Information Revolution, people actually say there's a new ethics that needs to be listened to and developed in order to come to terms with this thing called the information age. If you look at the around the world at the kinds of ethical policies and guidelines, this is the Ten Commandments of Computer Ethics by the Computer Ethics Institute, American Institute. Very quickly, thou shalt not use a computer to harm other people, thou shalt not interfere with other people's computer work. 3, thou shalt not snoop around in other people's computer files. I like that one. 4, thou shalt not use a computer to steal. Very similar to the Ten Commandments in the Bible. Thou shalt not use a computer to bear false witness, again. Thou shalt not copy or use proprietary software for which you have not paid. Interesting one, isn't it? 7, thou shalt not use other people's computer resources without authorization or proper compensation. 8, thou shalt not appropriate other people's intellectual output. 9, thou shalt think about the social consequences of the program you are writing or the system you are designing. Quite often people do not think about the social consequences. This is an important one. 10, thou shalt always use a computer in ways that ensure consideration and respect for your fellow human beings. I've just lost my screen again. And number 11, do not be a yobbo on the internet. I like that one. Do not be a yobbo on the internet. That is, you know, be normal, be sensible. Even though people don't know who you are. I wanted to show you that, in fact, there's a huge variety of topics that fall under the rubric and umbrella of computer ethics. I just printed off some of the topics from a conference, an Australian conference from the year 2000. I'll just go through some of them. Development of the net in Oceania, right, in the Pacific. The discourse of artificial intelligence, ethical critique, public education and training. Does an internet identity exist? It's an interesting one. usability testing, revisiting informed consent procedures for testing internet sites. Is it possible to teach computer ethics via distance education? Cops, computers, and the right to privacy in the information age, unauthorised access and inappropriate disclosure of information complaints in New South Wales. Electronic work monitoring, obviously, surveillance. The Online Services Bill, theories and evidence of pornographic harm. Anything to do with censorship and pornography is an ethical debate. The impact of knowledge, discovery and data mining, information warfare and ethics, and so on. Putting hackers to work. One of the most interesting areas of ethics that I've come across fairly recently has been this area of visual ethics. And I just want to run past you a few slides that you may not be aware of. That this paper comes from a journal called Technical Communication that I subscribe to because I'm a member of Society for Technical Communication. And ethics is something that can be applied to a lot of activities and areas of social life, as well as, you know, computing. Ethics can be a part of the visual representation of accidents. The authors, Dross and Vega, of this particular article, say that whenever accidents occur, quite often the visual aspects of reporting that incident officially and formally are dumbed down in terms of the human content. That is, when people report accidents, they tend not to talk about people, real people, and real death. What they tend to do is they tend to talk about abstractions, and they try and leave pictures of, you know, dead people, even names of dead people, out of the whole picture. Why? Because it's distasteful in our society. It's distasteful in our companies and organisations in order to... It's too horrific. The two authors say that this is wrong, and that, in fact, in order to make the powers that be understand what is happening in some cases and get change to accompany these reports, they say that, in fact, you can't hide humanity. In fact, you need to expose humanity in these visuals, especially. Not just the text, but actually in the visuals. Because visuals, of course, carry the emotional content. And if you dumb it down and make it palatable for the onlooker, then you also dumb down the message. That is, something needs to be done about these particular problems. Figure 15, these come from real reports. In this map of a New York collision between a school bus and a dump truck, all right, you see everything pictorially. The vehicles come to a final rest, but there's no mention made of human occupants. They're about the vehicles here, the school bus, the actions of vehicles and movements of motor vehicles. There's no mention of people, in fact, in this particular illustration. This is, if you look at this one over here, the only photograph of human beings in an accident report on TWA Flight 800. It's an aircraft disaster. The victims are basically invisible in a 425-page report. You only see people in the salvage crew. You never see bodies. You never see limbs, whether they're in black and white or colour. They're not depicted in this particular report. So someone has gone to the trouble, maybe a team of people, has gone the trouble of producing a 425-page report on a total air disaster, and there's no mention, really, of the people who died. Apart from the fact that perhaps probably all of them died. There are no names, no serial numbers, you know, nothing like it. No depictions of that disaster. What you do get is locations of key witnesses, all right, to Flight 800 explosion. They're depicted as circles on this particular map over here on the right-hand side. So humanity disappears, in fact. This is the school bus accident. Again, you get a picture of the exterior crush damage of the school bus. And what else do you get? You get the seating pattern and the injury diagram of this side. Now, this is technical communication at its best, maybe it's worse. This is the final resting position of the vehicles. It's a very difficult thing to see, but that's the dump truck and the school bus again. You see the bus, you see the truck, you don't see the people. Moving on a little bit, I did some more research and came up with the fact that the ACS, the Australian Computer Society, in fact, has a code of ethics which can be found on that particular website there. You only have to look up ACS Code of Ethics using Google and you'll find it pretty quick smart. There are no problems in locating this information. The deputy, the director of Community Affairs Board of the ACS himself, this is this guy Tom Worthington in 1993, basically said that he was talking at a conference at the time, and he said that, you know, if you belong to the ACS, and everyone in this room probably should, if not already, if you do belong to the ACS, then what you really need to do is take on board their code of behaviour. He says that himself, it's not something that you would look up every day or memorise, but it's there in case you need it. He says, he brings up three examples of using the code. Firstly, for protecting private information. Secondly, for reporting unethical business practices. And thirdly, for dishonest salespeople. That is, he reports incidents where, in fact, he was in a quandary. He really didn't know what to do. He knew that something wrong or inappropriate was going on in this computer context. And so what he had to do was look at the code and see what the appropriate course of action was going to be. Just to give you one example, protecting private information, he says, my employer collected information from the public and was required by an Act of Parliament to keep it confidential. My job was to wire up our branch offices so that they would have access to the data. Now, how do you do this but maintain the confidentiality of the data? That his job was, you know, as a programmer, system administrator, network administrator, he had to wire up everybody and make sure they had access to the data. Obviously, he says, technically, one technical solution would be to encrypt the data. However, data encryption equipment costs money. We didn't have much, so why waste it protecting against the remote possibility of a breach of the system? That is, it might have been possible for someone to hack into the system and violate other people's privacy. That was illegal. And so he said, I resorted to the code of ethics and advised my superiors that I would not implement the system without encryption or similar protection. To do so would breach my professional code of ethics. If they didn't like it, they could sack me and hire someone else to do the job. The encryption equipment was approved, of course. But he had justification for it, and he fell back on the code of ethics. Secondly, he said, reporting unethical business practices. Who do you report these to? This is the problem. Do you report them to Consumer Affairs or, you know, some other body? He said that he was advising a company on IT implementation plans. So I started to notice an apparent collusion between the company's staff and a major vendor of equipment to rig the reports in favour of that vendor's products. That is, he saw certain people in the organisation who were colluding with one particular vendor who were pushing his products. There might have been some kickbacks, there might have been some friendship there, but he didn't see it as a fair and honest transaction. So he said, I consulted my code of ethics and was obliged to inform my superiors, but nobody else. All right? Because this is an in-house thing. This is a company deal. There was no one else to inform, really. So he informed his superiors. The company would be less efficient with these computer systems, he said, but not severely threatened. Obviously, there were some cost savings, perhaps, by going with the favoured vendor. The health and safety of the public, they weren't directly at risk. You know, there were no occupational health and safety issues here. There was no evidence of corruption, which would stand up in a court of law, he says. So, I put my concerns to my boss in writing. They were filed and they were forgotten, he says. No action was taken. I declined further involvement with this particular project. So he did his best, informed his superiors in writing, and then just left it. It's up to them. He couldn't go any further. Obviously he had a job to do, and basically I think he must have, you know, finished the project and that was it. Dishonest salespeople, I'm just going to leave that one for later. Okay, so that's the end of the lecture, and I think that what we're going to do in the tutorial is actually bring up some of these case studies. Make sure to have all the website, because there are extensive links to organisations on the website. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Roy.